Thank you. I'd like to bring the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Policy and Finance Division meeting to order. And we actually have some minutes from Wednesday, April 2nd. Is there anyone who would like to... Representative Nornes, would you care to move the minutes from April 2nd?
I would be happy to do that, yes.
Thank you. Representative Nornes moves April 2nd, 2008 minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. We are now... Do you have a bill? No. Okay. We actually are going to switch around the agenda a little bit and move up number 5 to the next, and that would be the Barber and Cosmetologist Examiners Board discussion. And first of all, I think we have Gina Strauss here, who is the Executive Director, and she's going to come and speak regarding the board. And Ms. Strauss, what we'd ask you to do is just state your name for the record, and please just give us an overview of the board, what it does.
Members of the committee, thank you for having me here. Alongside me is Frank Plant. He is our board chair. He is a barber board member who is currently sitting as the chair. I do have a handout for you that will go through what I'm going to be talking, just the overview of the board. The board was created in 2004 by legislation that merged the Board of Barbers with the Cosmetology Division of the Department of Commerce. It was created as a standalone agency that is housed with the other health licensing boards, along with an administrative services unit that provides support to the health licensing boards. The board is structured. It currently has 3 barber members, 3 cosmetology members, and a public member. The board regulates and licenses over 40,000 different types of licenses. This includes approximately 1,500 barber shops, 2,500 barbers, 4,500 cosmetology-related salons, and approximately 30,000 cosmetology-related individual licenses. Each year, we approximately increase our total licensees by about 10%, and we 4% of our licensees do not renew. This also includes, we have over 28 different types of licenses and registrations that we oversee or give licenses and registrations to. The board's budget currently, we receive a direct appropriation from the state's general fund to cover the operating costs of the board. The board's revenue is $1.5 million. $252,000 of that is generated by the barbers, and approximately $1.3 million of that is generated by the cosmetologists. The board has currently appropriated 51% in this biennium of its revenues, and that equals $829,000 in fiscal year 08 and $729,000 in fiscal year 09. The board staff, we currently have myself, which is the executive secretary, 4 full-time in-house staff that process licenses, with one position recently vacated. And we have 4 full-time inspectors out in the field and 1 part-time temporary project manager. That is the overview of the board. I would be happy to answer more questions for more specific information in regards to the overview.
Are there any questions from members?
Yeah.
Representative Ruffina?
Madam Chair. Prior to the merger, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not as well versed on this as Representative Gunther, but the cosmetologists were over at the Department of Commerce, right?
Representative Rubina, that's correct.
And then, so I'm just curious as to what the staff was at that time, because the barber board was independent and the cosmetologists were. So have we seen an increase in staff, regardless of whether you were at Commerce or now as the independent board of barber and cosmetology?
Ms. Stowe?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I have been on staff since September of 06, and to get specific numbers exactly of how many were employed in the Department of Commerce versus the Board of Barbers, I believe that when it was the Board of Barbers, there was one executive secretary and one inspector. And at one point, I have been told there was 11 inspectors in Commerce. Then it got down to one in-house person. I can't accurately give you those numbers in regards to how many staff in Commerce there was.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And members, I'm the one guilty for causing this big fiasco that's been ongoing ever since the bill passed. Originally, the cosmetologist board was eliminated by Governor Quee. It was then put in the Department of Commerce, who had oversight of it. And the Department of Commerce had many problems, such as hair braiding and many other fiascos, and they wanted to get rid of it in the worst way. And you turn around and you had 1.5 to 1 inspectors for the cosmetologist, and they were paying, I think, biannual licensing of $2 million, as I recall. And I thought that was a little heavy for 1.5 inspectors and testing. So I thought maybe we should do something so they get a little autonomy by themselves. They'd be able to function more as a governing body for their profession. They'll be able to uphold the standards that they want to uphold. So I went to the barbers and I said, you know, if we could figure out a way to merge the two, the Department of Commerce will let us do that, and the governor will let us do that. What happened was the barbers very reluctantly said yes. And the circumstances that they said yes was, we are greatly outnumbered by the cosmetologists. We can't operate democratically. We have to have our board and their board, and then there's a master board that deals only with the merger of the two. And we take care of barbers, and they take care of cosmetology. And under those circumstances, they figured that they would be able to take care of their profession, and the cosmetologists would have the autonomy to do what they wanted to. And, like I say, Ken was kicking and screaming, but he agreed to it. And originally, and I can read it in, the barber members of the board shall separately oversee and administrate enforcement of their regulations, it says right here in the bill, and the cosmetologists will do the same. And the barbers did it with one inspector that would, in a timely way, inspect every barber shop. The cosmetologist, I talked to cosmetologists that hadn't been inspected for 10 years. Totally unsatisfactory. They didn't have oversight. They didn't have the integrity of their profession upheld at all. So what they wanted to do is they want to hire some inspectors, and I'm glad they did. And I said, well, it doesn't make sense to have a barber go and inspect in a barbershop with his barber and a cosmetologist together, have one go inspect that shop, and then have somebody else come later and inspect it. So the barbers, me asking Ken, is it all right if we merge these two? Well, the inspector's barber head didn't care for it, but Ken said, yeah, it makes sense. So that's what happened. However, since that time, it's my understanding, and I think we'll hear testimony to the fact that it hasn't been the way I outlined, that they aren't operating autonomously. The barbers are not making their rules and taking care of their integrity of their occupation and profession. And the cosmetologists are doing what they want to do according to information I get. So it's my will that I did, and when I passed this bill, that they operate and control themselves. One has no oversight over the other. The board is equally having, the overall board equally has the same number of barbers as cosmetologists. So that was my hope that would happen, and I think if it would have happened that way, we wouldn't be here today. However, I am certainly going to be open-minded enough to listen to what they have to say.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And 28 different licenses. How many of those are falling to cosmetology, and how many of those licenses fall just under barbers?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, it would be approximately 19 to 20. I could figure it out if you give me a few minutes. Specifically, I didn't list them all because there were so many. Mm-hmm. But I don't know it's just to show you that we have 28 different processes that we have to follow, regardless if it's a barber or a cosmetologist. The licensing assistants still have to understand the 28 different processes.
Madam Chair and testifier, would I assume right if that most of those different licenses would fall into cosmetology versus a barber?
Ms. Stoff? Madam Chair and members of the committee, the percentage would be significantly greater, maybe 80-20.
Substantive Detmer.
Madam Chairman, would I be correct in saying that probably many of the barbers now would like to be having their own government board? Have you got any of that feedback from the barbers?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, in regards to opinions or what out there, I don't feel that it's appropriate for me to personally address them, but the board in December of 07, with both barbers, cosmetologists, and the public member, it being a full board, voted that they would vote as one and want to vote as one unified board. They acknowledged there needs to be some statutory changes with what's currently out there in our statutes, but I think you could pull, 10 people and 5 would be on one side and 5 would be on the other. When you're looking at having 3 members, 3 barber members, 3 cosmetology members, and 1 public member, there's a lot of questions that come into play, such as Chapter 14 administrative procedures when we're looking at filing complaints, and then you would be down to maybe 2 members if you had only a 3 barber member section. Who's the chair? What's a quorum? There's a lot more questions that are out there that would need to be addressed.
Just a final, I can only speak for 1 barber. That's my barber, and I guess that shop is not happy with the current situation.
Thank you. Representative Ruth Vina?
Madam Chair, Ms. Schultz. Well, I think Representative Gunther knows what the legislative intent was, and I think the statutes are pretty clear. So, I'm wondering whether the board voted in December 07 or not, but all of us at this table are lawmakers, but I often tease my nephews when they tell me to wear my seatbelt that I didn't vote for the bill, but I know I'm breaking the law. Okay? But I can't change the law because I don't like it unless I pass it here. So I'm wondering what the rationale is for the board to not separate the votes of the barbers and the cosmetologists like the statute clearly implies.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, since the minutes in August of 2004, when I can go back, the board has always voted as one since 2004. I understand that this has become an issue as of late, but further on the advice of the Attorney General, who advises the board, there are 2 conflicting statutes, which is Statute 154.001, Subpart F, and 154.002, Paragraph 4, and I do have a handout that highlights these areas. Which does talk about oversee, administrate, enforce, and the Attorney General has advised between Paragraph F and 154.002, Paragraph 4, which talks about a majority of the board in a meeting assembled can perform and exercise all duties. I understand it doesn't clearly say vote, and the board does want to resolve this, but the board has done this since 2004, vote is one. further, the other issue is that the public member is not acknowledged in subpart F. So what is their role? Do they actually have a vote? Because if we follow part F to the T and not account for 154.002 paragraph 4, the public member has no role. And are they to go to two board meetings if they are to have two separate board meetings? And currently there's really only one topic that neither the barber specifically regulates or the cosmetologist, which is hair braiding. Hair braiding falls under an unregulated service which the board has been assigned, and that currently is one of the only topics when they meet if they met as a whole in a master committee that they would need to be discussing then.
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, and Ms. Strauss, again, when there are conflicts in statute or in rules, and I'm trying to figure out the statute, I guess, you look again at legislative intent, and I think Representative Gunther has reiterated and reemphasized that the intent when he passed this legislation was that they both separately, because there was a reluctance to merge the boards in the first place. So, I guess we'll have to take input and do this in the interim from both the barbers in the state and the cosmetologists as to what they would like to do to clarify how these votes should be done. But I'm curious with the member, excuse me, and I didn't get your name.
My name is Frank Plant.
Mr. Plant, you are a member of the barber part of the board. So what kind of input are you getting from your members?
Mr. Plant.
From members of the barber industry?
The barbers themselves, yeah.
As far as I have any contact with the barbers I have contact with, I haven't gotten any complaints at all about the way the board operates. The way things are going right now, everything is working. It's working well. It's working as a combined board. We discussed the barber issues amongst the barber members. We discussed the cosmetology issues with the cosmetology members, and then we vote as a whole. So if there are questions brought up, the barbers discuss the barber side of it, cosmetology discusses the cosmetology side of it.
And Madam Chair, when you vote as a whole, I mean, did you assume that you could because of that opinion from the AG's office?
That's the way it was. I was told to operate.
By whom?
When I was nominated to the board just a year and a half ago by, at that time, Chairman Tom Platt.
So the chairman of the board told you that?
At the time, yes.
Where?
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is, I don't know if this is related or not, but if there's 28 different licenses, are there 28 different tests that you administer? And do you do the actual licensing as well of all the licenses that you administer?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, currently the board, the barber board members administer the practical examination, and that's three different styles. One would be the apprentice, one would be the master, and one would be the barber instructor. It's not, we outsource the exams, depending on which exam it is. Written exams are all outsourced, but it's 28 different types of licenses. Yes, we do license them in-house. All the paperwork comes to our office. We are responsible for accurately determining are they qualified for that license, and then mailing out, issuing them that license, collecting the fee, et cetera.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just the only concern that I've had that's been brought to me by barbers in my district are just the number of opportunities for new licensees to take the test. How often is the barber's licensing exam given? What are the opportunities for that in the course of a typical year?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are four exams. One is in February, one is in May, one is in August, and one is in November with the opportunity for two additional exams. At this point, I have never had that concern brought to my attention. And typically, the exams are not 100. I mean, there's typically we can always accommodate everyone who's applied. I don't. In my time, we've never denied anybody the ability to sit based on not enough room.
Madam Chair, the concern that was brought to me a year or two ago, I can't remember how long, but was a young barber who was going to be licensed, and he had signed a contract to cut hair in a shop in my town. And the day of the exam, there was a huge blizzard. He couldn't get here. And he was told he had to wait 4 months or 3 months before he could take the exam. And I guess that's really the only complaint that I've heard, and I guess that's just kind of by way of information. But it just seems to me that I think what Representative Gunther has said is that there was originally intent, and I was here at that time too, and I don't remember all the discussion in detail, although I do remember that there was controversy back then too. I guess it would seem to me that we should be looking at getting back to what the original intent was, because I think that's where the agreement came together, and that was the understanding that the participants had. And if we've deferred from that and moved away from that, I think it's something we should look at and make whatever adjustment we have to make statutorily or in process, so that we are really matching the original intent that was understood by the legislature at the time.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I wanted to bring a concern that's been brought to me several times in the last several years. We actually changed the law dealing with cosmetologists just maybe 3 years ago or so to require that the licensing exam would be given in the language of the person who was applying for it, because we have a lot of problems with people who are highly skilled coming from other countries or living in this country and not able to get licensed because of language barriers with the licensing exam. Nothing to do with their qualifications. They've gone through all the schooling. They've done all the work. And I'm just wondering if we could have a witness to come and talk about that. Because my understanding is, even though we put that in the law, what I was told several months back is people are still not being offered that option. And it's very difficult for some people to be able to take the exam. And so I'm just wondering if we can have a witness to talk about that, give an update. Because if there were, if people are wondering what concerns are, this is one of them. Cosmetologists having a hard time getting licensed.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, may I address that question first?
Yes, ma'am.
I am aware and I have met with individuals in regards to this issue, which this deals with individuals coming in from another state or country to be offered the exam in a foreign language. Currently, we've been in a contract with a testing company, and they only issue cosmetology exams in four other states, five including ours. And in order to have it translated into another language, it has been very fiscally expensive for us to do that. Knowing that our contract is expiring, we are going to be putting out another RFP, and one of the requirements in that new testing company would be that you would offer that in Spanish or potentially an Asian language. We haven't specifically identified it. However, in the interim, what the board has accepted is that an individual can have a certified interpreter or a state-rostered translator to be able to go in and sit with them during their exam to translate the written portion of the test when they're coming in from another state. It is the written portion, and we do allow that for both people coming in from reciprocity as well as initial licensure. It is on our website. We have the forms available. We've tried to get the word out as best we can that a interpreter is available.
Ms. Strauss, maybe I have a follow-up question for that as
sure.
Well. It seems as though there's a relationship that the board would have with the legislature, and a couple of instances you mentioned that you just sat on it or didn't seem to respond, and one being this situation where if you've got somebody who comes to you and they're seeking it in another language, and that is what is the law to do, I'm just a little curious about what your process was to either come to the legislature and say, we need more money, or our resources are lacking in this, or we're not able to yet do this, or, you know, something. I guess I just have a question about that. Just follow up on that, please.
Yeah, Madam Chair, when that statute was enacted, I was not with the board. I got made aware of it once I got hired. It actually, to my knowledge, the board members at the time when it was enacted weren't even aware of it. What we have done is we did the best that we could in regard to last year. In the budget cycle, I asked for, I think it was like $250,000 in my base budget. I asked for $420,000 this year. And we are well limited in our resources, and considering that we'd have to put out thousands of dollars for a testing company that's going away when in the interim, the interpreter or translator has seemed to not cause any problems with the people asking for it. It's something that has been decided that fiscally it would be best to put that in our next RFP. When the testing company was issued to the board, again, the board was basically lumped in with Department of Commerce and some of their like welding insurance exams, and we didn't have the opportunity to really make the RFP specific. And again, I go back to the current testing company, since they are only in five states, they don't offer it in a foreign language right now, so we can't just go pick it up. They have to build it from the beginning.
And if I can just follow up again, I have a couple of questions on that. It seems as though then you're putting the burden on the person seeking the test and giving them some added responsibility to be able to meet the requirements rather than the board meeting the legislation and providing that. So my follow-up question, I guess, is just on, is there only the sole testing source? Can you seek an alternate testing agency that would be able to provide that, or are you limited to just the one testing source?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, yes, we are limited to this current testing company with the contract expiring, and again, we'll be issuing an RFP for a new testing company. I understand that there might be a small burden placed on the licensee. We are trying to, in the limitations we have, because I believe in the statute it does state it's within our available resources to provide it in a foreign language, so this is the step we have made to try come to the meet in the middle with the licensees, and understanding that we have to make it in a foreign language, and then it's picking which languages, which is what we will be doing with this. It'll be a requirement in the URP. The other testing companies out there that offer approximately the other, 45 states currently already have a test in the foreign language. Ultimately, the current testing company just was not a good choice by the Department of Commerce when we got wrapped into it back in, I think it was 2004.
Representative Clark. Well, there's two things. I would like to make you, and I guess the board and our committee here, aware of what the real problems are, so I would like to have some testimony, because there are problems. There's not even a sign that tells people that they have the right to request the test in their native language when they go to apply for the licensure, and that's real basic, that you have something on site to let people know that, and that's been requested and it hasn't been provided, or if it has, it's been sporadically provided from the information I've gotten. We can hear a little more. The other thing is, if I'm not mistaken, I think about 50% of the fee for cosmetologists goes into the general fund. Is that right?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it would be 50% regardless if it's a barber or a cosmetologist.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, I think your question was very, very good.
Yes.
You know, if this money is intended to serve the professions that it's that are paying it, why is it going into the general fund? Well, I guess that was some of it was taken to pay, you know, for budget shortfall or whatever. But if that is denying a whole group of people who are the cosmetologists and perhaps the barbers in some cases too, the services that their fee is paying for, then there should be some adjustment to that, I would say. So with that, I guess if we could have
we'll
a little Representative Clark, I'm just going to make sure if there are other questions right now to Ms. Charles, but But we will be bringing up other people. Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said that sometimes you provide interpreters, and I was just wondering if the applicants ask you if they can have an interpreter, and then if you pay for the interpreter to get the exam. Madam Chair, members of the committee, they fill out a one-page form that either goes through a certified translating company, if you are provided at the bottom, or a state roster. It is up to the applicant to either get paid for the interpreter, or potentially the state roster people may do it for free. We don't get involved in the paying of the and what funds are exchanged between that the examinee and but everybody anybody is available to fill that form out.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, what percentage of the people coming in, the applicants, would you say then do need a an interpreter?
Madam Chair.
Are you talking a lot of people here or a certain small number? I'm just wondering the cost involved.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, our current database could not pull out accurate figures in regards to which percentage. I would say since we have come up with this form and a translator request, I probably approved maybe 15 to 20 and never denied. If there's a denial, I call and we work out why there was a denial. It's maybe because they weren't on the state roster, they didn't understand the certified, and we work through it. I myself personally handle all these requests to make sure they're expedited and sent over to the testing company, because at that point they get a private room because there will be talking going on rather than at just a normal computer system.
So it seems that they are taken care of as they should be. I mean, I just was wanting to make sure that people weren't denied, but you are following through on these particular people.
Absolutely. Madam Chair and members of the committee, absolutely.
And maybe as a comment on that and a follow-up, you know of 15 to 20 perhaps that are denied, but you really don't know how many people are coming forward speaking. Is that correct?
No, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I have probably only received approximately 15 to 20 applications in probably 8 to 10 months that have all sat for the test with a translator interpreter. At this point, if there's ever an issue with their application to sit with a translator interpreter, we personally call them to figure out why, to be able to get them to sit with someone. But nobody has been outright denied, to my knowledge. And
all right, Representative Gunther, did you have your hand up?
I did, Madam Chairman. Certainly, if there's one person that can't speak English, and that person was a professional barber or cosmetologist, we have an obligation to make sure that person gets the best job they possibly can have. If that means that we have to hire an interpreter for every one of those, we should do that without any doubt. And if you are short of money to do that, we can, by coming back to this committee and asking for an increase out of the general fund appropriation to take care of that. Whenever you have anything that goes different than this bill, it's a simple process of finding a legislator and saying, I'd like to go before the committee and change our regulations and rules. And we'd be glad to accommodate you. One question I have for the barber. When you discuss in your meetings, do you discuss matters of cosmetology?
Mr.
Klein.
The members of the board who are the cosmetologists discuss the cosmetology issues.
And you discuss only barber issues?
Right.
Okay, that's the way it should be. How many members are there on your board in barbers?
Three.
Three on each side and then one public member.
And one public member.
Okay.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Just to go one step farther, so if you meet as a board and you operate as one single board, but you kind of separate the responsibilities of the board, when there's issues that relate to barbers and there's a vote on that issue, how does the committee handle it? Do the cosmetologists vote?
Mr. Plan?
Right now, everybody is voting on every issue as the board votes as a whole.
And Madam Chair, I think that's probably getting to the core of the issue, is when the decisions are made. You can discuss it all you want, but when the decisions are made, it should be only barbers voting on barbers' issues and only cosmetologists voting on cosmetology issues. I mean, that's really the way the vote should be occurring. It seems like that's really the core of the issue here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if that's how the legislative intent was to work, there's just some follow-up questions that I think need to be addressed, and if that is also putting it in the statutory language, we need to look at that, because how does the chairmanship work? Because it's currently a barber member, and he's the chair of the entire board. I guess the board would just need some definitions. What's a quorum? Where does the public member vote on all? Do we have two chairs? Hair braiding would be a topic that, like I mentioned earlier, is not barber or cosmetology. Chapter 14, which is the administrative procedures when we work in complaints, I think that if that's the decision on how the board needs to go from today forward, I think there needs to be some follow-up questions answered to give the board guidance, because that is not in our statutes or the rules.
And Ms. Phelps, you're suggesting that you would be asking those questions then?
Absolutely, yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
And then, but this seems to be something that's been a question for at least a year or some time, and I'm just curious about the relationship between the board and the legislature, and if that just wasn't well understood.
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, since the minutes in 2004, the board did not roll call vote. So there's no way to determine when they approve something. There's no way to specifically determine if the cosmetologist or the barber voted, but there's definitely no nays or abstentions, so then you have to assume they all voted as one. And since 04, that's how they voted. And that's when I joined as the executive secretary, that's what's been going on. So it's not a problem that per se arised in the last year then. It's something that was the problem when the board first merged at their very first meeting.
All right. Are there other questions right now from Ms. Stroh? Otherwise, I do believe we have Elzado Rivera. If you would like to step forward, please. To provide some testimony regarding Welcome to the committee. If you would please state your name.
Thank you. My name is Alvaro Rivera, and I'm working with Latino Economic Development Center. I just want to tell you, member of the committee, my impressions about this situation and around the license for the cosmetology and other things. I have a client who came from Mexico. He has his license over there, and she tried to get her license here, you know, to have his own place and everything. We start to help her, but unfortunately, even that we found in the Gina and the person right now, the staff right now in the office, a lot of help and cooperation, we found a lot of trouble for this lady to get her license. She had to present the test 5 times, and using the one in the last one, she passed. She knows exactly what is the things to do around her experience and about her work, but unfortunately, the English is not good for her. So we know. I mean, I'm working with this institution since the last year, but coming for the other co-workers, I know that the trouble was before, and that somebody offered to translate the test in an appropriate way, but nothing happened still. So really it's a nightmare for the people who don't speak English to get that test.
Mr. Rivera, the people that you've worked with, have you gone to the website? Have you seen information from either
on the web or in printed form or in any other place or way to be able to describe what their process would be if they don't speak English?
Well, yes. The board has in the web some form to be filled out for the person, you know. So, I mean, probably, as some of you suggest, it's not fair that the candidate pay for the fee that is expensive, more than $50. They have to pay for the fee. And also, the candidate have to pay for the translator, you know. In our case, and I want to repeat, we get the help from the board in the way to help our clients with one of our co-workers, you know, and that work was approved any time without any doubt, you know. The process is the problem, you know. The English approach of the question is complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So we, in our meetings with the secretary, Ms. Gina, we suggest to try to change even that kind of question, because it's the something that you call here tricky.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Rivera?
Just one of the things, and I'm sorry, I had to step out to vote in another committee, so I don't know if you mentioned this, but I know that part of the problem was people having being informed that they have a right to be able to ask for the test in the language of their first language. And if I recall in some of our discussions, there's no posting of that information at the site where people go to sign up to take their test. I think there has been at times, but it's not there consistently. And so people sometimes don't know they have a right to ask for the test in anything other than English.
Well, if they don't have a really good knowledge about the computer system in this country, and they are not able to get in a web page exactly the things that they need, yes, it's a confusion, you know, it's a confusion. The people is afraid also, and not only the people who ask for the license in the cosmetology board, just to go to the office, because they know that nobody speaks his own language there. So, in that moment, the situation starts to be an issue for the people who don't speak English.
Thank you. Representative Clark, did you have a follow-up?
No, I want to thank you for hearing the testimony. And I'm wondering if there is, you know, something that can be done soon. We have people who are hardworking people. They want to be able to work in their own profession. They have experience in some cases, having even in some cases owned their own shops, and you know, just they're not able to provide for their families in the way they want because they can't get licensed, even though they should be able to. And it's just it's a language barrier. And I think both the written translation, the need for that, and then the opportunity, which I think sometimes occurs more easily than others, for the interpreting is an issue. And I think if it's a matter of resources, because when we passed the law, we did say within the realm of existing resources, that seems to be an out, you know, that it's not taken very seriously, you know, and it could be. And I think maybe we need to do something that allows more of the fee to go to the board and their resources, and rather than be, you know, divided in half and half of it go to the general fund. It's not serving the purpose of the people who are paying the fees.
Thank you. I'm not sure if Mr. Rivera has any more comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. And Representative Gunther may have a question for you.
To this point, if an applicant that doesn't speak English and needs help taking the test would notify the Board of Barbers and Cosmetologists to get an interpreter in a timely fashion and then take the test, it would make sense. And if they are in fact short of money, they simply, all they have to do is come to this body and ask for an increase, and we will transfer money from the general fund portion to their board. And it just seems like it should work very smooth. We can't expect them to have someone there to speak all the different languages all the time, but if they have enough lead time we should absolutely accommodate those people.
Thank you, Representative Gunther, and I know you've been a real supporter of this kind of access, and I appreciate that. I'm just wondering, Madam Chair, if maybe we should figure out how to transfer some of those dollars. I think it's very reasonable. People are certainly willing to plan ahead of time. That's not the issue. You know, that's very reasonable to be able to do that. But is there a way, I mean, I don't know if you're considering in any way acting on the fee this year, but it seems to me like that might be something we should consider.
Okay, and Representative Gunther.
I think our able committee administrator could certainly talk to the person the person who runs the board of barbers and cosmetology to find out if they have a money problem. And if they do, I think we could probably draft a bill that we could amendment that we could put in the conference committee to perhaps address this issue and other issues.
Well, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Ruffian.
Chair, you know, as minor as that amount might be, it probably still would be. Have something, Mr. Berg, that would screw up our targets, and because that money going to the general fund has to be counted. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, yeah, it's a matter of priorities. I mean, if money is appropriated from the general fund to the barber board, it has to be counted for.
So, what we could do, and members, the alternative would be to give them direction to raise the fees, and then we'd have to probably go to the tax committee, because remember, a fee is a tax now, so it might be a little difficult to do this year at this time, but, you know, I would imagine that there's a little bit of money over there, and I asked the question, and I see there's someone here from finance, and I won't prolong it, but, you know, if I'm not mistaken, Representative Gunther, there was a little more money appropriated at the barber's board after the merger than previously had been there, and there's more staff there also, so I think there could be some money found to help out what you're trying to do.
Okay, Representative Eastland is next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What does a licensed applicant pay to take the test now? You know?
I'm asking you to bring Ms. Phelps back down to be able to answer some questions. Ms. Stouse, did you hear the question?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe I did hear it. How much do they pay for the examination?
Correct.
They pay $51 to the third-party vendor who administers the exam. For cosmetology, their application is separate. So the $51 they pay for the exam is not, we don't collect any of that revenue. The amount we collect is solely based on application fees. Now, the master barber and the apprentice exam, the board does administer that, and in their examination fee, so they pay $65 for the practical exam, and then that gives them their license as well for the remainder of the year.
Right,
so, but ultimately, the $51 goes to the third-party vendor.
Madam Chair, then if an RFP is going to go out for a new vendor, mm-hmm. couldn't that be part of the RFP, so then the license fee would then cover it? I mean, it's not something that comes from the general fund anyway. So, I mean, the point is, if it's going to say $60 for a license to take a test to cover the cost of having an interpreter for someone who needs that, that could just go out as part of the RFP, so when they pay that fee, that is a covered service.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the RFP that will go out, a requirement would be is that they offer the exam in another language. So regardless if the third-party vendor is going to charge them $45 or $65, whatever they set their fee at, that opportunity to take it in a foreign language would be available once that RFP process goes through.
Next is Representative Clark. Question on this?
I lost track of my question. I guess I was thinking that. I know what it was. I'm wondering how many other licensed professionals have 50% of their fee diverted to the general fund. Do we have any idea about that,
Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, the 50% I can't tell you. Generally speaking, almost all the professional licensure boards are getting less money appropriated back than their fees generate.
all of the professional licensing boards in this committee get less bags than they're being generated.
And how,
I think that's true across most committees.
And my question is, how long has that been the case?
25 years in my case.
But I'm just wondering, it seems like 50% is a pretty darn big...
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I guess I can't give you a history lesson. I know the problem has been getting worse in recent years.
That's what I thought.
All right, I'm going to move to Representative Hodge.
Of my license fee. So
I was just wondering, you know, if you're only dealing with 15 cases,
70%?
You know, or even 20 cases, if in fact was the interpreter's costs are less than $4,000 for those, you know, certainly for those cases. I mean, it seems like something that would fit into an operating budget.
All right, now, Representative Mahoney, did you have a comment or question? Did you now have a question?
No, I answered him.
You answered your question. Okay. Anybody else have another question? Otherwise, we may have other audience members who would like to come down and testify. They would come to the desk. I think there's somebody back there. Could you please identify yourself for the record?
My name is Peggy Pitt. I'm the administrator and the instructor at the Minnesota School of Barbering. I could give you a lot of history lessons. I could tell you about Representative Clark and myself have had several conversations about the interpreters, and I could clarify some things if you want to re-ask the questions. I have a lot of answers for you today. I'm pretty active. You probably all got emails from me. The barber and the hairdresser's merger has been, as you all know, a big problem for all of us. I go to a lot of the board meetings. In 1974, I was the chairman of the barber board myself, 74 to 80, so I'm pretty intimately involved with the barber board. I was at a board meeting one time when the cosmetologist told the board member who refused to vote on hairdressers' issues, if she didn't like what was going on, she could resign. That happened three times at different meetings. So in terms of her exercising her right to abstain because she was following the statute, as Representative Gunther wrote it, there's a lot more to this than meets the eye. I did hire an attorney in 2004 at great expense to myself because I thought I understood Representative Gunther's statute to read that they would not be voting on each other's issues. And at every single meeting, there is voting on each other's issues. I have a stack of minutes from those meetings to back up what I'm saying today. Rather than get into all the minor details about that, because I think the interpreter is probably a better way for you to spend your time at this meeting, I'd like to just respectfully suggest that we separate the meetings, not necessarily the board, but perhaps separate the meetings. Maybe the barbers will meet one time, the cosmetologists will meet another, and maybe every 6 months they could get together and have an administrative meeting. That way there would be no muddying of the waters. They could still administratively save each other money by, you know, sharing the office and that kind of thing. And when it's a barber issue, the barbers will address it, and the hairdressers won't even be there to discuss it. When I go to a meeting and I hear people giving their opinions on things that they really don't know the history of, you can well imagine that it kind of rubs me the wrong way. I've been a barber since 1969, so I have a long history in barbering. I take a lot of pride in being a barber. And I do know what the status quo is. I have been instrumental in changing barber laws in the past. Senator Pogermiller helped me change a couple laws. And Representative Gunther and I had a long discussion before we had the merger, and he assured me that this would not happen, and yet we're here today and it has happened. So perhaps just having two different meetings would fix the problem. And then maybe once or twice a year have an administrative meeting, and if they saw a problem with that, maybe more often. But to tell a barber who is the chairman the chairman of the National Association of Barber Board of Examiners. If she doesn't like the way things are going, she needs to resign. We can't continue like that. That's just totally inappropriate. So, I can answer a lot of questions.
Representative
Rukavina
has a question.
Ms. Smith, maybe I'll ask you too, because I asked Mr. Plant, but are you getting a lot of complaints? I mean, you have a lot of interaction with barbers because you taught a lot of barbers in the state how to be a barber. So what are you hearing out there?
Well, I heard a lot. I send out a newsletter that goes to every barber in the state of Minnesota, and my phone rings off the hook. And you guys probably get emails from me all the time. The barbers are not happy. They are not happy. And I probably talk to 50 barbers a week. Sometimes they're asking for interpreters. Sometimes they're asking for the phone number because they can never get through to the board. Sometimes they're asking me, are there new laws? Are there new statutes? Because I do send out a newsletter. And I do, it's kind of a fun little newsletter. And sometimes it's a little gossipy. And sometimes it's a little, you know, there's a little barbs in it, but I do have a lot of interaction with barbers, and I probably personally talk to more barbers in 1 week than the barber board does in a month. And I've had a lot of negative feedback.
Well, Madam Chair, I think we're going to, you know, have to work with the current board and staff, and Representative Gunter's probably was involved in this in the first place, and maybe come up with something that'll try to get back to the intent of the law. I don't know if I, you know, agree that administratively, or if they have to meet separately or at separate times, but I think, you know, just to get back to the barber's vote on the barber issues, the cosmetologist vote on the cosmetologist issues, and then as a full board, they talk about the administrative issues and other issues where you said there were, you know, were gray areas, and licensing where they both apply. So maybe that's some kind of a compromise we can reach. But Madam Chair, if there are no other questions on the particular issue of the board separation of the voting, I would like, because I see the Office of Higher Education people are here, because Ms. Smith brought an issue to me regarding the fact that I think in a few years, the workforce development money will not probably be able to be used to train barbers. Maybe it's the same for cosmetologists, I'm not sure, because of an accreditation issue with the federal accreditation. And I don't know if you want to just briefly talk about it, and then we can bring people from the Higher Education Board up here.
Ms. Smith, you can go ahead and respond, and then you can bring somebody else in if you want to.
Madam Chair,
I know it's on the agenda to talk about, but while she's here, that's fine.
Minnesota Higher Education Coordinating Board passed a statute that requires all schools, in order to participate in state funding, would need to be federally accredited. There's 23 of the schools that are going to be affected by this new statute that's going to go into effect in 2011. I've sent in probably 20 of the letters to Representative Rukavina from these schools, represented who do not wish to have federal funding. We do not wish to have federal funding in their school. I have had federal funding. It's very, very expensive. And for small schools, there's only 23 of us that are going to be affected by this. Now, most of the letters, you know, most of the people that I've talked to, and I've talked to 23 of them, said that they would probably close their doors because they can't afford to go federal funding. Most people don't understand why we have to have the federal government telling us what we need to do in order to get state funding. So I approached Representative Rukavina and asked him if he would help me before that statute went into effect to see if we couldn't get that just expunged, or whatever the word is to use to make it go away.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe at this time we could bring someone up. I see we have folks from the Office of Higher Education and get a little handle on this. It's probably something, we do have some time on it, but, you know, I'm afraid, too, that if we make it prohibitive for these schools to get workforce development money, that we're not going to have anybody enrolling in the classes. So maybe...
you want to come forward and state your names for the record, and...
Madam Chair, Krista Grimes with the Office of Higher Education.
And my name is Cheryl Maplethorpe with the Office of Higher Education.
All right. And to Representative Rukavina, do you want to just ask your question again? Or did
right,
you hear the question?
Right, and I think Grimes, you know the issue, so I guess maybe you can explain to us what's going on and hopefully some way to solve what could be a problem.
Just go ahead.
Madam Chair, if it's all right, I'm going to start with just a few sentences about our relationship to the Barber and Cosmetology School. In general, in state statute, it provides that if a school is already licensed by another state agency, they don't, generally speaking, have to relicense with our agency. We do regulate not-for-profit and for-profit post-secondary schools. And if they are not licensed by another state agency, they are clearly under our jurisdiction. Brown College might be an example, for example, of that. Argosy University would be another example. If they use certain words in their names, like academy, institute, or university, then they come under our statute and they have to license with us. Or if they have massage programs, they have to license with us. But generally speaking, we don't exactly license them. The issue that has come up is eligibility to have their students receive state grants and state self loans, state student loans. What has come up is some schools don't have the administrative and financial capacity that they really should have to operate as schools. And unfortunately, more often than not, the schools that we have trouble with, and we do have a handout, the schools that are that small, about three-fourths of them are cosmetology schools. And we have had situations where a school would get licensed by our agency 1 week, and the next week they start having their students get self loans. And the school told us, well, that self loan is paying all the bills around here. Well, loans to students are not meant to be small business loans to help the business operate. So that made us uneasy. We've also had situations where schools would operate for a few months and then go out of business, and the students are left owing student loans, and they haven't received their full training, and it's a problem. And so as we talked about this in the office and we talked about what to do, one of our other concerns was that schools that don't participate in the federal Pell Grant program, their students don't know that they could be getting a Pell Grant if they went to a different cosmetology school that does participate in the Pell Grant program, or a different, any other kind of school. It's not just cosmetology and barber schools for whom this is an issue. And so we thought we would like to be sure that the students are getting the financial aid that they could get, both federal and state. And we're also concerned that some of the students who are not getting Pell Grants may be taking out state student loans that they might not need to take out if they were getting the federal Pell Grant. Now, we need to be straightforward about the fact that it is expensive for small schools to get accredited and participate in the federal program. It probably costs $20,000 to $30,000 for a school to get accredited and start participating in federal programs, and it probably costs about $20,000 a year for a school to continue to be eligible. They have to continue to pay accreditation fees, and they have to pay occasionally for federal auditors to come and audit them. So we want to make it clear that it is indeed a burden on the small business. We considered having a set of state standards for administrative and financial capability, and we decided that rather than having a separate set of state standards from the federal standards, it made more sense to simply say, since we wanted to make sure that the students were getting Pell Grants anyway, let's have the institutions just meet the federal standards so the state doesn't have to have a duplicate but slightly different set of standards to how to operate.
Thank you.
And I can understand your concern and certainly want every student in this state that's going to a higher education institution or an apprentice program or whatever you want to call them to be able to use federal money if we can. But I don't know how many, do you know offhand how many barber schools we have in the state barber schools. I'm not talking Endicott County School, and how many would be able to do what you're trying to get. I passed this bill last year.
Yeah, yes, I did.
It says Minnesota Census 2006, though.
Right.
Well, I wasn't 2006. I wasn't chair of the board then.
No, Madam Chair, actually, I believe it was in 2007 that it passed. That maybe our citation wasn't quite right. I'm sorry. I may not have put 2007 supplement in there the way I should have. But it's my memory, it was the 2007 session. I could be wrong. One other comment I wanted to make is that, for example, let's say a school had 20 students. And those 20 students are currently getting a total of maybe $40,000 in state grants right now. And we did look at that list, and a number of those schools have quite a large percentage of their students getting state grants. If they're getting state grants, chances are very high that they're also eligible for federal Pell Grants. And chances are that their students would receive $40,000 or $50,000 in additional money in Pell Grants. It might be possible for a school to somewhat raise their tuition, cover their costs of getting accredited and staying accredited and participating in the Pell programs, and still the students would be getting more financial aid money than they're getting now. Free money that they don't have to repay, grant money.
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, what I'm afraid of is that, you know, we all agree that we have a shortage of trained workers coming up here. And I'm sure the same holds true for barbers and cosmetologists. And if we are going to make it tough for these schools to stay in operation, who's going to train our barbers? You know, you brought up the issue of and cosmetologists. You brought up the issue of cosmetology schools where they qualified and then they closed. But we must have a history of schools that have been in existence for quite some time. As an example, Ms. Smith has been in, I don't know how long. She's been in operation, she's been cutting hair since 1969. I don't know if her school's been in operation for 20 years and have graduated a number of students. Wouldn't that be an indication that perhaps that school is, you know, a legitimate one that still is going to be around a long time? We've got a little bit of time to work with this, so I would just hope that we could think this thing through, and maybe that the Office of Higher Education perhaps could help guide some of these smaller schools into help them guide through the federal accreditation process. I don't know, is there a federal accreditation for barbers and beauty schools? I don't know that, but you know, you could help them with that and then let them make the decision. But still, you know, our workforce development money that's used to help people more in the trade than in other things is not controlled by the federal government, and I don't know if your decision to tie that to federal rules and restrictions is a legitimate one, or even, you know, something that we should strive for. So yes, that's all I'm saying. I don't want to be able to, you know, I used to have long hair and a ponytail, and I threatened to go back to that, but you know, I just don't know if I want to do it right away, Representative Amber.
Go ahead. Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, you asked a question that I failed to answer before. I'm sorry. To my knowledge, there are two barber schools in Minnesota, and neither one of them is currently participating in the federal Pell Grant program.
And so, what do you think, what will happen if they don't? How do we train barbers?
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, that would be a problem.
Representative Bruce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just and hearing the testimony, and I'm concerned, too, about the schools as well as the students, so I'm trying to figure out what the tuition is so high, but it looks like it would balance off. The students would get more. And I guess the one thing, too, that I'm thinking about, it seems to me that the schools would want to be accredited because of, and going forward, because, I mean, I'm thinking the two barber schools now that are not accredited, then I would guess that the counselors would be guiding students to the schools that would be accredited so they can have access to the Pell Grant. So it seems to me that it would be, I mean, it makes sense mm-hmm. to me that it would be worthwhile to be accredited. And also, if some of the schools are, I mean, I can hear testimony, Ms. Grimes, that some of the schools are using this money to stay alive, and then the students are kind of left in the lurch if they go down. So it seems to me to be very a positive move, since we do have until 2011 that to work towards that.
Ms. Benz, did you have a follow-up on that? Or?
Madam Chair, our goals are really two main things. To get students the financial aid money that they are eligible for, or would be eligible for if they were going to a school that was participating in the federal Pell Grant program, because that's free money that they don't have to repay. And to try to make sure that the schools have enough administrative and sort of financial aid expertise to get the students what they need.
Thank you. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Poppy. And to Ms. Grimes, could you enlighten me as to what is the average cost, or what would the cost be for a school to go through the accreditation process? What's the cost and what's the time required just to go through the paperwork?
Madam Chair, Representative Welty, my understanding is that the total cost is something on the order of $30,000, and that it probably takes a year and a half to 2 years to stay accredited. May cost as much as $20,000 a year, although probably staying accredited is a little less than that, but the school would need to budget for the fact that they may have to pay for federal auditors to come and go over their procedures.
Is there any other questions? So, let's send the department.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wonder what is the rationale for having this particular category of school be federally accredited in order for us to let students use the state grant there? Because I'm just not sure what the value added is for the public.
Madam Chair, Representative Department. The federal government has, through trial and error over the years, developed a set of administrative capacity kind of standards. Schools have to be operating for 2 years, for example, before they can get federal student aid funds. They have to have a trained financial aid person working at the school. And there are some other, administrative capacity and financial viability standards. And those are the kinds of things that we thought, instead of inventing a separate set of state rules in that regard, that perhaps we could just use the federal procedures.
Representative Hartman.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Grimes. But when we're talking about state money, and this is a new requirement, that in order to get the state grant that people be going to a federally accredited school, we must have some set of requirements now that we use to determine what an eligible institution is. And And so I can understand the rationale for changing it for a whole host of post-secondary education options, but maybe in the case of this category of institutions, it doesn't make sense.
Madam
Chair, Representative Portman, right now all they have to do is be licensed or registered in the state of Minnesota. And our licensing standard, we do some review of their training and their financial capacity and so forth, and require them to post a performance bond and to have an agreement with another institution that if they should go out of business, their transcripts of their students would be kept for 50 years. It's a modest but not terribly onerous level of regulation that we do with them now. Your suggestion about, grandfathering in existing schools, the legislature could certainly do that if they wanted to.
That's the final follow-up. Now, I'm not suggesting that we grandfather in existing schools. I'm suggesting perhaps maybe there is an exception for eligible institutions that are cosmetology or barbering schools, that they do not have to meet Roman numeral 3. I just wonder if in this case why we care what the federal accreditation process is when we're talking about somebody who's going to be a barber in the state of Minnesota. We already have this licensing procedure in place.
Representative Portman, some of the schools that we've had trouble with that didn't have enough administrative capacity and financial viability were cosmetology schools. That's one of the reasons it came up. But really, the thing that motivated us was wanting students to get the Pell Grant if they were eligible to get the Pell Grant. And they can't do that without being federally, without being accredited by a federally approved accredited school. Sorry.
of Sin Department.
It seems to me that that could be a business decision that the barbering schools and the cosmetology schools could make of whether they think there's enough of an enhancement in the students that they would attract that they want to go through the federal accreditation process. But when we're talking about state aid that we as state lawmakers want to make sure that students have access to, if we want to help somebody go to cosmetology school, I as a state lawmaker cannot explain to the people of the state of Minnesota why I would only give that student aid to a student who attends a cosmetology school who's paid the $30,000 to be federally accredited, when I think that the practice of their profession is adequately regulated at the state level.
Maybe, I'm just wondering if perhaps there is some guarantee associated with accreditation. Maybe not a guarantee is the wrong word, but there's some sort of security blanket, at least with an accredited body of a higher education.
Madam Chair, I think it's possible that some people automatically assume that a school is higher quality or that students are getting better training if they're accredited, but I can't say I think that would
that's
rise
not,
to the level of care.
Actually, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just wondering about, I work at an accredited school, and I'm just thinking that typically there's more, it's like being an FDIC, you know, bank. You actually know that there's something there, that if you go and you pay the money, you know, there's some guarantee that you're either going to get the training or be able to, you know, have the length of time to be able to be there, and it isn't going to close its doors. I guess that's maybe what I'm just suggesting.
And Madam Chair, I think in the area of where we're giving an associate degree or a bachelor degree and somebody could get that in Minnesota and then move to Wisconsin and they don't go to any state board of licensure and say, oh, my associate degree is good here too, right? In barbering and cosmetology, in order to practice in Wisconsin, they would have to get a license in Wisconsin. So I think that perhaps there's a different issue there and maybe we could exempt them from that requirement.
Thank you. I think Representative Welty, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Judge Tesfar. I just want to get clarification on this. So if we do nothing, are we going to take away the state aid to any of these schools? Yeah.
Madam Chair, as of July 1st, 2011, if we do nothing and the schools don't get accredited and get signed up for the federal programs, then their students would no longer be able to get state grants and other state financial aid as of July 1st, 2011.
Thank you for that clarification. And then I'll just leave it at that, thing.
Okay, I think actually we do have a bill that we need to go through next, and what we wanted to do was air the issues regarding the board, and I think that we've had the opportunity to do that. I believe that Representative Ruth Convina will probably follow through on some of the suggestions you've heard to be able to do some things regarding what actions the board should take. So thank you for your testimony, and we'll move on then to House File 770.
I'm sure move House File 770 be recommended to pass and re-referred to, I imagine it has to go to Representative Murphy's committee. And members, it's a pretty simple bill requested by the commissioner of IRA's resources for the Giant Ridge Recreation Area and expansion of. When this was passed, the city of Bowabic was in the process of annexing parts of White Township, and there's also some unorganized townships now that need to be included in it. So that's basically the portion of that bill, and then I have an amendment to it because, members, I might need a vehicle bill because of the fact that we're in discussion right now whether or not some of our policy issues that we passed in the bill have to be pulled out. I hope they don't. I think most all of our language in our bill referred to the financial things that we were doing, but that's the reason I'm trying to do this, so I've got a vehicle bill to pull our policy eventually. So, members, I would move the A1 amendment, which will basically make my bill better, more germane, if I have to pull policy issues into it.
Okay.
So I'm being very frank with
So I'll move the A1 amendment.
Representative Rukavina moves the 80770A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
Amendment
passes.
Madam Chair, unless there's questions, I'll move the bill as amended.
Any questions for the author?
Eventually. It'll have to go through Representative Murphy first. But I think it just can be by referral, but I'm up to the full finance. So it'll fit in finance, and if it's needed, Representative Horman, it'll be there.
Representative Rukavina then moves House File 770 as amended. We recommend it to pass, and we referred to the Committee on Education, Finance,
and
Workforce Competitiveness. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed say nay.
Members, before we break up too, then I think Tuesday we're going to have a little hearing on the St. Paul Technical and College, Community College wants to show us what they're doing with virtual reality classrooms. But I also want you to be aware that it will be the last official day of our committee administrator, who's just done a remarkable job, who will be going to the Office of Secretary of State. I frankly can't understand why he would want to leave me. Because regardless of how some of you think of me, I am really a good boss. Well, we're going to have him say that publicly, I think. But I want everybody
to get his last check.
I think we're going to have a party for him, though, on Monday or Tuesday, and we're going to have cake and everything. And, you know, I told Sue, well, we got a nice cake, and she said, well, what should we put on it? Well, how about putting on his... I really didn't want to argue, but now I'm really sad as hell you're leaving. She said, you can't put that on there. So we'll still figure something out. So if anybody's got any suggestions for what we put on the cake, I'm more than willing to entertain them. With that, okay. Members, I just want to publicly thank him. I think he's done a wonderful job.
Madam Chair? Yes,
Representative
Clark.
Can I also just add, I mean, it's been fabulous working with you, Jim, and this is the first time I knew. I didn't know that you were leaving. So I just want to say...
Well, I think you wore him out, Representative Clark.
Well, I was going to say, he's always been there. You know, whenever I've needed anything to work with your committee, and you've just been terrific. So wherever you go, I know you'll do a great job. Go ahead.
And Madam Chair, I really appreciate the appreciation that you're showing for my work, and just want everyone to know I did send an email out a couple months ago when this position was offered to me with the Secretary of State's office. I did not seek out the position. I'm very happy where I am, but it was an opportunity that was very difficult to pass up, and I really appreciate working with Representative Rukavina and for Representative Rukavina, and he is a very good boss. He's the best boss that I've had. So.
On the record, too.
Before we adjourn, I just had a question of Representative Rukavina. The virtual classroom, is it going to be at the St. Paul College?
No, it's going to be here, but the presentation will include what they do, and I don't know if it'll be piped in from or what.
Okay, I was curious the way you presented it. I wasn't sure. All right, any other comments? Otherwise, we stand adjourned.